Ariel Sharon, Ehud Olmert, Yitzhak Rabin. Lithuania, Ehud Barak. Poland, Benjamin Netanyahu. Hungary and Romania, Yair Lapid. Or Poland and America, Naftali Bennett. All presidents of the Zionist entity, bar three, came directly or indirectly from Poland, Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, or in one case, Austria. The obsession with proving that the Jews, all of the Jews, are indigenous to Palestine flies in the face of the overwhelming evidence of the settler colonial nature of Zionism and the fact that most of those in charge originate in Eastern Europe. Even the Zionist paper Haaretz has published an article claiming that the argument that Jews are indigenous to Palestine swims in fascist waters.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Tony Greenstein. Tony's a veteran anti-Zionist activist. He's a founding member of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and of Jews for Boycotting Israeli Goods. He's a long-standing anti-fascist and author of A History of Fighting Fascism in Brighton and the South Coast. Tony's a prolific blogger and is about to publish a book titled Zionism During the Holocaust. Welcome to the show. Tony, let me start with you. You've written extensively, haven't you, about the history of the Zionist movement. Do you think many people know the principal leaders of the Zionist movement, or actually from Ukraine and other Eastern European countries?
I'm not sure. Many of them are, but not exclusively. The founder of political Zionism, Theodor Herzl, was a Viennese journalist who worked in Paris. So he was a West European, not an East European. And arguably, Zionism was a West European phenomena directed at ensuring that East European Jews didn't come to Western Europe, but went to Palestine. So although the origins were in Poland and Ukraine, the brains were in many ways in the West.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I was going to ask you, David, whether it's actually true that Zionism originated in Ukraine. I mean, given what Tony said, I mean, what's your thoughts? Well,
in many ways, it did. I mean, the Odessa area in Ukraine was a settler colony where Jews came from other parts of the continent and settled there. And then later, many of them moved to Palestine and became part of the occupation of Palestine. The Odessa was known as being the gates of Zion. Many of the early Zionists came from Odessa. Jabotinsky, of course, famously was raised there in Odessa. And many of the Zionist youth groups that still exist today started in the Ukraine or in modern-day Belarus. So yes, there is a strong sense in which Ukrainian nationalism and Zionism, which grew up in parallel, had something really very similar to each other. And that's an interesting aspect of the way in which Zionism as a form of nationalism has developed, I think.
Mm. I mean, Tony, it seems that there's an attempt by Zionist leaders to sort of deny those European origins. I mean, is that a fair assessment, do you think?
I'm not sure. I mean, you see, Zionism is based on the idea that it hates the Jewish diaspora. It wishes to wind it up. So it wishes to forget its origins. I mean, yes, most of them, Ben-Gurion, came from Płońsk, a small town in Poland, for example. But they all changed their names to Hebrewize them, and they all hated the Yiddish, the language that was spoken by the East European Jews. That's why they created a new language, Hebrew, because literally they hated the Galut, as they called it.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, we've just seen in the film, David, that many of the Zionist leaders changed the names in the process of becoming settler colonialists, didn't they? I mean, how significant do you think that is?
Well, I mean, they changed their names. I mean, Tony was talking about Ben-Gurion. His name was Grun, Green. And Golda Meir, she changed her name. Almost all of them changed their name. Jabotinsky changed his name from Vladimir to Zev. So this is a part of a Judaization, Hebrewization of them, so that it would appear that they had some kind of more intimate connection with Palestine than in fact they did. And of course, it's part of the process of colonization to present themselves as being somehow indigenous to the area. Just like the attempt to colonize hummus and falafel as being Israeli cuisine. Yeah. These are all part of the same thing. It's part of the process of colonization was the changing of the name.
Yeah. I mean, Tony, does your work on the Holocaust and Zionism help us to understand the national origins of Zionism?
It's a good question. I'm not sure it does. My work on the Holocaust really shows how the main priority of the Zionist movement during the Holocaust was building a Jewish state. What was happening to the Jews inside Europe is very much a secondary matter. Not only was it a secondary matter, but when people tried to find a place of refuge for the Jews who managed to flee from Hitler's inferno, the Zionists opposed it on the basis that, well, if you could save Jews somewhere else, what was the point in having a Jewish state? That was the logic, if you can call it that, they followed.
I mean, David, tell us about Golda Meir's description of herself as a Palestinian.
Well, you saw that in the film there. It's an interview from a British TV programme from some years ago. I'm a Palestinian. And she was Ukrainian. And, she moved to the States and then to Palestine. And she talks about it in terms of the passport that she had between 1921 and 1948. She had a Palestinian passport, and she goes on to talk about how there was no such thing as Palestinians. So she says, on the one hand, I was Palestinian, and on the other hand, there was no such thing as Palestinians. There were only Jews and Arabs, and that's an interesting way of putting it, I thought, because, of course, many of the Jews were Arabs, and this is an attempt to suggest that Jews and Arabs were not the same thing. So there's an attempt here, as part of the colonizing project, to present Jews as being something entirely different from the local people.
I mean, I'm sure the discussion that we're having today will be seen as very controversial by the Zionist lobby, and no doubt will be accused of indulging in anti-Semitism again. I wonder, perhaps, David, how would you respond to those charges? Maybe preempt some of the criticisms that we're almost bound to get for providing some factual historical background to this whole discussion.
You can't run away from this. This is the history of the colonization of Palestine. This is not about Jews in general. This is about specific groups of people who came to colonize Palestine. Some of them came, most of them came initially from Europe, or origins in Europe, and then others came laterally from North Africa and from other parts of West Asia. And these people were completely different people. They were a completely different ethnic group. Mm. They happened to share Judaism as a religion. And so there's an attempt in this historical process to flatten that distinction, to make it out as if there was only one Jewish people and that they had their roots historically in Palestine, which, of course, turns out not to have been true.
I mean, Tony, you're Jewish yourself, son of a rabbi who confronted Oswald Mosley's fascists at the Battle of Cable Street. I mean, you know, is this a case of Jewish exceptionalism, do you think, the way in which, how the kind of Zionist lobby respond to discussions like this?
Well, yes. I mean, Zionism is a movement based on Jewish exceptionalism, that whatever anyone who's Jewish does cannot be criticised. But the essence of Zionism in Palestine was that it was a Western European colonisatory movement, and in fact, they weren't even aware, most of them, of the fact there were Arab Jews. Arthur Rupin, who was maybe the most important personality in Palestinian Zionism before the Second World War, he was a social Darwinist. He believed in survival of the fittest, and he had this belief that the West European Zionists and Jews were not Semitic, unlike the Arab Jews. And so for the hard labour in Palestine, he employed Yemenite Jews. But because of his pathological, eugenicism, they were paid starvation wages. They weren't given medical care. So 50% of the Yemenite workers died off. They died off like flies because they had this attitude to them that they were the Untermenschen. They were not fully human beings.
Well, let's just pause the discussion there for a moment, because we've got another report now that examines the historical origins of the two main groups of Jews in the world today.
Zionists increasingly deploy the idea that the Jews, considered as one indivisible people, are indigenous to Palestine. The term decolonized Judean is used by Zionists, often white Europeans, to describe themselves. But is there any remnant of the original Jewish people expelled 2,000 years ago amongst the two major groups of Jews in the world today? The dominant group, massively overrepresented at all levels of the power structure in what is called Israel today, are Ashkenazi Jews. Recent research in linguistics and genetics shows that the Rhineland hypothesis, which suggests that Ashkenazim comes from the Levant and Yiddish originates in Germany, is unable to explain the genetic, linguistic, and cultural data now available. It suggests instead an Iranian Turkish Slavic origin for Ashkenazi Jews and a Slavic origin for Yiddish. A killer detail in the argument is the existence of, along the ancient Silk Road trade route in northeastern Turkey, of four primeval villages whose names resemble Ashkenaz, such as Ishkenaz. Ashkenazi Jews then appear to have no historical connection to the original Jews of Palestine. The Sephardi Jews are the second main group of Jews in the world. They're increasingly populous, and according to some accounts, now make up a majority of Jews in occupied Palestine. But they also face a well-known pattern of discrimination in relation to the white European Ashkenazi Jews. When they arrived in occupied Palestine, mostly after 1948, these groups often spoke a kind of Arabic and were sometimes referred to as Arab Jews. This was a threat to Zionism, which made sure to discourage their use of Arabic and assiduously worked to de-racialize them. Some left Zionist and anti-Zionist groups tried to present the Sephardim as a benighted ethnic minority. But if the aim is to wean Sephardim away from ultra-Zionism, this is a strategy doomed to failure. Once they become settler colonists and their connections with the Arabs were severed, their primary loyalty came to be the Zionist project. But this cannot erase the fact that the Sephardim are Arab Jews, as is widely accepted in the humanities and social science research literature. Even more pointedly, linguistic and genetic research shows that these so-called indigenous Jews are predominantly descended from North African Berbers and Arabs. The truth is that Ashkenazi Jews come mostly from Eastern Europe, with origins in the Caucasus, Turkey, and Iran. Sephardim are mostly of Arabic, Berber, and some European origins. They are Arab Jews, with perhaps as little connection to Palestine as the Ashkenazim. There is no unitary Jewish people with any historically continuous claim to the land of Palestine.
David, what's the background to the academic and scientific literature that's overturned the idea that Ashkenazi Jews originated in Germany?
Well, there's a guy called Wexler, Paul Wexler, who's a linguist at an Israeli university. And he's written several books on this topic. And he's been joined more laterally by a number of others, including a number of other Israeli Jewish social scientists and scientists who have done this kind of a geographical population studies, which have shown the way in which the Ashkenazi Jews originated along the trade route, or the Silk Road trade route in northeast Turkey, coming up from Iran, through Turkey, and over towards the west. And the work that they've done is stunning, really, if you look at the data which underlies it, and in particular showing the Slavic origin of Yiddish, which they then say was relexified to German, i.e. most of the German vocabulary was replaced, the original vocabulary, but the language itself was Slavic in origin. So this suggests that the Ashkenazi Jews are Slavic, Iranian, Turkish in original origin, and don't have any real connection to Palestine, to the Jews who were expelled back in 70 AD. So it's a really interesting scientific dispute, and there is a dispute about it, but increasingly it looks like the dispute's has been won, and it's becoming a common position.
Sure. I mean, Tony, what's your view on this debate? I mean, how do Zionists react to the idea that Yiddish is actually a Slavic language?
I don't really know. I mean, I'm not sure that it's particularly relevant. I mean, Zionism makes many claims about the biological, the genetic, the racial, if you like, origins in Palestine. And to be quite honest, it really does not matter. There were 2,000, 3,000 years ago, there were many peoples, Canaanites, Moabites, you name it, Edomites, who were wandering over the land. The idea that you can now make a claim based on a particular group of people who lived in Palestine 2,000 plus years ago is absurd. I suspect if the West Bank settlers met the original Hebrews, they would be shot on sight as terrorists. I mean, that is the reality. It's complete rewriting of history back into time. So I'm really not at all worried about it because it's completely bogus. Western colonists have always justified their presence in other people's lands by virtue of the Bible or other religious texts.
I mean, I've got to say, David, this discussion about the origins of these Sephardic Jews was kind of new to me. I mean, perhaps you could say a little bit more about that.
Well, again, this is this guy Wexler, who's a linguist, and he's done this research. He's written a book on this, a whole book on it, showing that the Sephardic Jews, the word is Hebrew for Spanish, so right. Supposed to be Spanish and Portuguese Jews. Right. And actually, that contrary to this conception, the ethnic origin and the genetic origins of these populations is in North Africa, and from Berber and Arabic stock, and some European stock as well, with a really small component of the original Palestinian Jews from back in the day. So even the ones, the Sephardim, who are regarded as being kind of indigenous to Palestine, don't have a clear claim to that, and actually descend from the Berbers and from Arabs. These are Arabs, and there shouldn't be a distinction between between Arab and Jew in the way that there currently is in much debate.
Mm. I mean, certainly this notion of Arabic Jews seems to be quite widespread in academic literature. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, firstly, I mean, what you call Arab Jews often aren't Arab Jews. I mean, I'm no expert in the different ethnicities, but I understand Berbers are not Arabs and neither are Kurds, but there are Jews heavily concentrated amongst both groups. So Jews were indigenous, if you like, to Arabia, but not particularly to Palestine. They dispersed. I mean, David said the Jews were expelled in 70 AD. I have to say, this is a Zionist myth. There is no evidence whatsoever that there was any expulsion. This, is history being rewritten back in order to justify a colonialist narrative. So, yes, of course, but you know what happened when the Arab Jews were brought to Israel after destabilization, because Zionism destabilized the community in Iraq, Morocco, etc. They were de-Arabized. They were treated as dirt. You look what happened to the Yemenite Jews. Thousands of their babies were stolen, literally, in the hospital. They were told they were dead. And then they were given to either American or Israeli Ashkenazi parents. And some of them were subject to quite horrific medical experiments. Yeah. I mean, all of this has come out despite three white inquiries. So they were treated as dirt. They were recreated. They were de-Arabized. That is the reality of what happened.
I mean, briefly, David, we haven't got much time left. Arabic Jews, Jews of Arabic origin, do face discrimination. Do you think that, gives us a prospect of a serious challenge to Zionism or not?
I think not. I mean, I think that there is a feeling among some in the Zionist left and some in the anti-Zionist left that might be something to work on. But, I think if you compare it with other settler colonial situations, like especially the question of Ireland, the settlers, especially the working class in the settlers, are the ones who become the most devoted and the most extreme, and that certainly is the case with Ulster loyalism. And I think probably it's also seemed to be the case with Sephardic Jews inside the state of Israel.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now, as we're right out of time. Thank you to Tenny Greenstein and to you, David Miller, our resident expert, for joining us today. And we'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. His
really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to your own program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in the studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Sheikh Miqdad, who is a researcher in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome. Today, we would want to discuss with you an issue many parents do have. One of the questions that I want to ask you is that there's a 12-year-old who is struggling with sleep and is so messed up. How do parents deal with this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So sleep is very important, especially at this very sensitive age of teenage, 12, 13-year-olds. Sleep kind of, the whole body goes through change, right? Physical maturity, body goes through change. So sleep is very important that we take care of it. Couple of things. One, obviously, at this age, children tend to become lazy, mm-hmm. right? Teenagers go through a stage where they become kind of lazy, where they want to increase the level of sleep. I remember when they're very young, they wake up at 6 in the morning and parents are kind of pulling their hair out. Why do my kids wake up at 6 in the morning?
Yes.
But then when they turn 15, when they're 13, 14, 15, children don't wake up until 12, 11 a.m., 12 noon, 1 p.m. And then parents, again, are pulling their hair out. My child is so lazy, doesn't wake up until half the day is gone. We kind of have to hit the middle ground where it's natural for these teenagers to kind of perhaps require more sleep. But we have to be careful and make sure that they also have their exercise and they're also very active during the day. That will really help them too. So how do we do this? One is that together understand how much really a child needs sleep.
Okay. Right?
And you realize that usually 12 to 13-year-olds, 8 hours and above becomes more. They don't need that much. They're very likely we can go and sleep 11 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But they don't need it. They themselves will tell you, yeah, that was a bit laziness. That was just because I didn't have anything else to do. So one is to always kind of together with a child, with this teenage boy, discuss how much hours of sleep do you need. Usually it's between 7 to 8 hours, maybe a bit more, sometimes 8.5, but more than that becomes. The second thing is the time of sleeping. Again, teenagers love to stay up all night.
Yes.
Right? Slowly, you want to discourage that. Try and help them to understand the value of sleeping at night, waking up early in the morning, the value of doing things in the morning rather than at night time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very difficult challenge. Today's world somehow is sleeping very late at night and waking up late in the morning.
Yes.
Amongst the things you can do is make sure that they have activities starting very early in the day, activities that they like. So for example, if your child loves football, organize football at 8 a.m. Right.
Okay.
If your child can get some work going, especially in summer, for example, if they can do some activities that they really enjoy, make those things happen early in the morning. So they're kind of forced to sleep early at night.
Okay.
And those activities that they can do, that they're doing at night, if they can be moved to the morning and the afternoon, that would be ideal. But again, I understand this is sometimes very difficult. Balance it out. If you can, if it's very difficult, one of the other solutions you could do is have nap times.
Okay.
So they can sleep late at night, still wake up in the morning, early mm-hmm. in the morning, and then have a bit of nap time in the afternoon. But that's very difficult because by nap time, we mean half an hour.
Yes.
Maximum an hour. It should never be 3 hours of sleep, especially not on a full stomach after lunch.
Especially, yeah.
So we have to be careful of those kind of things. So play with a very important kind of notion of sleeping early at night, waking up early in the morning. But obviously in difficult challenges, things kind of arrange to help that happen as much as we can.
Well, we need to manage that as parents. What else we can do, I'll ask you after a shorter break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Probably you said that we need to manage time even in the afternoon naps. We have to make sure that it's for half an hour or so, but not for 3 hours for us. I personally, talking about teenagers later on, I personally have a child, a baby boy who is 7 years old, almost 7+ now. And he is like, if I ask him, if I try to tell him, please have an afternoon nap, because there's so much play, make mess around. And if I, for example, if I personally want to take a nap, I would first request him to go for a nap. And my son would answer like, the sun has not switched off yet. He understands the concept like we have to sleep only at night. Yeah. So there are even kids, there are especially boys, they really hate sleeping, be that at daytime, that at nighttime. What else can parents do to deal with them?
I would say it's a very good thing. Children to be saying that I don't want to nap. See, nap is only a requirement. So if children don't have to nap, then don't nap them.
True.
Ideally, they shouldn't even nap. It's not necessary.
Yeah.
And for a child to say, I don't want to say, I know, because I know what you mentioned, my 7-year-old hates sleep, whatever time of the day it is. And he says this explicitly, I hate sleep, right? But when he sleeps, obviously he sleeps quite a lot. But they do. It's a very normal thing. It's actually a very good thing. Children are full of life, basically. They want to be active. They've got a lot of things to do. It's very good.
Yes.
As a general principle, especially in teenagers, the more active they are, the better.
Yeah.
You want to literally tire them out, right? If you want your teenagers to go through a very good puberty period, okay, just knock them out, right? Like, do so much activity from morning to afternoon that they really get tired.
Okay.
Plenty of sports, right? Plenty of intellectual activity. Just keep them busy, on their toes.
Recreation.
It shouldn't be that they feel like, oh, I'm bored, I've got nothing to do. You've got a couple of hours of no work. No, that shouldn't
you
be the case.
Say, like, if I want my child to have sleep at early, I want my child to sleep early and wake up early, I should make sure that he also does not have a sedentary life.
Exactly. Yeah. Sedentary life is very much detrimental for a good sleep.
Okay.
Another point, I'll mention 2 points and I'll move on to a more important one. One of them is sleeping on a full stomach, especially teenagers. That should be avoided at all costs. So if you have bedtime, make sure bedtime is at least an hour or two after dinner. And again, if you're napping them as well, make sure that you're napping them at least either before lunch or a bit after lunch, not straight away on a full stomach.
Okay.
And secondly is the important point I want to mention is having a sleep routine is very important as well. The activities before sleep really have an impact on quality sleep.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about quantity of sleep, how much a child sleep. But also remember, quality sleep is important, if not more important. So sleep routine, many things you can talk about. So firstly, obviously, sleep routine means that you have a number of items of things that you do and you don't do before sleep.
Okay.
So for example, having routines like going to the bathroom, brushing your teeth, doing wudu, especially at that age, they can understand the concept of doing wudu before sleeping.
And this way you can introduce the concept of changing your bed into the mosque.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, as the hadith mentions. And they're wearing pyjamas, basically. So that's kind of 4 or 5 items they do before sleep.
Yeah.
Psychologically, what happens is that the brain mentally prepares itself for bed. They know if they do this for 2-3 months, okay. What will happen is that the moment they do these four things, they naturally feel tired. And they finally feel ready to go to bed.
Okay.
Another thing is, what are they doing before sleep? So screen time, avoid screen time 1 or 2, if not more, before sleep. Screen time doesn't help a lot. In fact, it's not just for kids as well. It's for adults as well.
Never sleep
with your phone next to your bed. Always switch off your phone 1 or 2 before bed.
Okay. So screen time is also important. How is that important? I'll ask you that again after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
The Prophet ﷺ said, "No father has granted a gift to his child better than good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Brother, you were talking about screen time.
So screen time, from a physiological perspective, the studies out there, you can Google it, you'll find it, how screen time affects sleep patterns.
Yes.
The light from screen and other factors as well leads to kind of not a messed up sleep pattern, but doesn't play a good role in sleep quality.
And that way they also become addictive.
Addiction to screen time isn't completely another matter. Obviously, you want to avoid them to be addicted to screen time. But in terms of sleep, having your phone on or having screen time 1 or 2 before sleep will actually have a detrimental effect on your
sleep
quality. Reading books and doing story time before sleeping is very good.
Okay.
So if you can encourage teenagers, 12, 13-year-olds, even before that as well, to read books before sleeping is not a bad thing.
Okay.
Having a reading culture at home is very important.
Okay.
But obviously, always monitor what they read. Mm-hmm. Encourage good books to be read. Even if it's novels, encourage good novels to be read. Good children's books to be read. Monitor that as well. But definitely have a reading kind of culture, even before sleep, is good. It's part of a good routine.
Okay.
And last point is sleeping and waking up kind of requires a mental decision as well.
Okay.
So teach your children, especially at this 12, 13 years, as your question you mentioned was a messed up sleep pattern, teach them and tell them about the power of your brain and the power that you have to kind of make a decision to sleep and make a decision to wake up. I'm not saying that it's completely in our control. Obviously, Allah is the one who brings about sleep and wakes us up. But for our body to be prepared to go to sleep, we need to make a decision. So children who say, okay, I know I'm going to sleep at 10 o'clock or 11 p.m., for example, make a decision that I'm going to sleep at 11 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
It'll help them sleep better. And again, waking up, same thing as well. Remember, at 12, 13, they should be waking up for Fajr already now.
Yeah.
And that should actually be a habit by now to be able to wake up at 12, 13. So if they have an alarm, make sure that they put them the alarm themselves and that they train themselves to wake up for Fajr. If they sleep after Fajr, it's not a big deal. They can sleep after Fajr, but they do wake up for Fajr. They make a decision before going to sleep to wake up for Namaz of Fajr.
Yeah.
And same thing, they make a decision to wake up in the morning at what time.
Yeah.
It should never be the case that you sleep in the morning, sleep at night, and you say, I'll wake up whenever I wake up.
Yes.
Right? If that happens, then you'll be sleeping until 12.
Yeah.
Teach your child, say, whatever time you're going to sleep, say, decide what time you're going to wake up.
Yeah.
It's fine if it's 30 minutes late or 1 hour late. That's fine, right?
Yeah.
But you've decided that I'm going to wake up at 6 o'clock. I'm going to wake up at 7 o'clock. I'm going to wake up at 9 o'clock. They make this decision.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like I'll wake up whenever I wake up and that's it. You just go and laze about.
Well, that was also a nice point. And parents can also help their children understand that sleeping time is a time when a child has to analyze what good he did, what bad he did throughout the day. And he can avoid bad things and they can encourage him doing good things again. Thank you so much, brother, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIV English Radio. This was Islamic Upbringing. In case you have any questions for us, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until another session, fi aman Allah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest. Allah, 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 Allah.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware. The hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
The supplication, which is the doyan of martyrs, Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him, has cited on the day of the feast, on the day of Arafah, mostly consists of things which can be used by people reciting it. There are, however, other things which are difficult to use even for noted mystics. Is there any manifestation for other than you? This is different from he is the revealer. Is there any manifestation for others which you do not enjoy? Means that all manifestation originates from you. Everything is your manifestation, O Allah. When have you been absent that you may need a guide to lead towards you? Never have been absent. All should deduce their manifestation from you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Muharram and the Ashura. In one of his speeches, he mentioned that Muharram is the month in which justice has risen up against cruelty, while truth has confronted falsehood, and has proved that throughout history, truth has always been triumphant against falsehood. In this part of his speech, obviously, he's talking about the importance of the month of Muharram. And that is true that this month of Muharram, it's all about the justice. It's all about raising up against the oppression, raising up against the cruelty that we see in the society. And it is something to raise up against the falsehood. And the Islam and the truth is always victorious against the falsehood. And this is what Muharram shows us. This is what Muharram tells us. This is the message of Muharram. And this Muharram is Muharram because of Imam Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam. The sacrifice that was given by Imam Hussein in this month, especially the day of Ashura, it showed us that how, if apparently the truth couldn't have the victory, and it has lost the war, but on the other hand, its consequences, but in reality, which we cannot see at that time, it shows us that the truth has always been victorious against the falsehood.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu
Hussein had the victory against the Yazid, the false thinking that we had in the society. The promise of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is that he gives victory to the poor ones. He gives the victory to the oppressed ones. against their oppression and the oppressors. And this is what Muharram is all about. And this is what Imam Khomeini is also referring to when he says that this month of Muharram, in which justice has risen up, this justice means that we give everyone's right to and we do not take their right from them. We have to pay attention to the rights of the people. And the first right which we need to take care of is the right of being servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And whatever Allah wants from us, we pay that, we sacrifice that thing for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And in the land of Karbala, in the 61th Hijri, we have seen that how Imam Hussein alayhi salam has sacrificed everything, even his life, for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, so that the truth can have the victory over the falsehood.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Insight. Good afternoon and welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing China-Iran relations in a conversation with Ambassador Chang Hua. But first, let's take a look at this brief analysis.
In March of 2021, Iran and China signed the 25-year strategic agreement following a process which began with Chinese President Xi Jinping's state visit to Iran in 2016 and his meeting with the leader of the Islamic Revolution. A strategic alliance of the two ancient civilizations of East and West Asia, who were dominated by foreign imperial powers in the 19th century and who were able to liberate themselves in the mid and late 20th century in two massive popular revolutions. Beyond the bilateral dimensions, this strategic agreement sent shockwaves throughout Western capitals, who had been dreaming of bringing Iran back into the Western strategic sphere of influence after the Islamic Revolution, through an imposed war in the 1980s, and through political destabilization campaigns, immoral economic wars, and full-spectrum maximum pressure sanctions, which were recently determined to be illegal under international law by the United Nations Special Rapporteur, who was tasked to investigate their legality and impact on human rights. Future historians might look at the history of the 20th century and conclude that besides the two world wars that shook the world, the two revolutions of China and Iran, which liberated these ancient lands, reawakened these ancient pillars of human civilization, and established the People's Republic and the Islamic Republic, respectively, are among the most significant events of the 20th century, with a very significant impact on global affairs in the 21st century and beyond. The rise of Asia, Eurasian integration, and the strategic alignment of China, Iran, and Russia spell the eventual end of US global hegemony and the beginning of the post-American world. The whole world is already benefiting from the moral wisdom of these two ancient civilizations' increased presence and prominence in global affairs, foreshadowing a future global system stressing mutual cooperation and peace over the crude, racist, imperialistic mindset of historically, relatively, and recently civilized tribes from a small peninsula on the western end of Asia, which were able to dominate global affairs for a few centuries through mass murder, slavery, and theft of resources on a global scale.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you for joining us on Insight.
I think we are now concluding that 1979 is a very important year. We have the reforms under Deng Xiaoping, and then we have the Islamic Revolution. So these future historians that we were talking about, maybe they will look at the year 1979 and realize this is when the world had a very important change of events. Before we get to Iran-China relations, I know I've been saying it a lot, but there's still a couple questions and a couple issues I want to talk about in terms of more, if you want to call it, global strategy, strategic issues, because we covered a little bit of history. Many experts, probably I would say there's a consensus even among experts, both in the West and in the East, that you know the 21st century is going to be the Asian century. It's already started. It's a lot of things are becoming clear. These nations that we talked about, Iran, China, India, East, Southeast Asia, a lot of things have been happening. It started in the 20th century, but the 21st century, many people are saying, is going to be the Asian century. And we were talking about this before our conversation, that this is actually the way that human history was actually, this is the normal way that human history was, that the center of production and civilization, if you look at the long history of human civilization, has mainly been based in Asia. And what we experienced in the last couple hundred years was maybe a little bit of an anomaly historically. There are some people, of course, who are not happy about this. And they are saying that, well, you know, if China becomes the leading nation in the world in terms of economy and in terms of power and all those other things, it's not going to be any different than the Americans, whatever the Americans are doing now. It's going to be the hegemon. It's going to be the same issue. At least with the Americans, there are things that we can talk to them about, like, you know, their liberal tradition. But no, China is not going to be like this. So if you could please explain to us, if we accept that there's going to be this transformation, if we're going to be entering into the Asian century, and that China is going to be probably the most dominant country in terms of economics and maybe even military and military power, is it going to be different than the Americans, or is it going to be just the same thing for us who are not either America or China?
It is a very interesting and good question, because we all live in Asia. China is in the east part of Asia and Iran on the west part. We could see that there are many countries with great civilizations and long histories in this region, like India and Iraq. I used to work in Iraq for some time. Iraq in the past was a great country. We should say that Asia should be the Asia of our own. Its affairs should be decided by its nation. At the time being, the majority of emerging markets and the majority of developing countries are located in Asia. I suppose we can make our own contributions to the world and its economic development. Because in the past, we could say Asian civilization was the great part and the major part of the global humankind civilization. At the time being, some countries are trying the so-called Indo-Pacific strategy. They are trying to start conflict among Asian countries. We are strongly against this idea. You just asked about China's role and play when it becomes a great power in the world. Would China's actions be different from the U.S.? I should emphasize that Chairman Mao clearly promised that China will never seek hegemony. Deng Xiaoping said the same thing, and President Xi also said clearly and emphasized clearly that China will never seek hegemony. We will never seek the so-called sphere of influence. We will never seek unrest, and I think this is a solemn promise and a clear answer to the world. I remember that the king of the French Empire, Napoleon, used to say that China is a lion. Once it is awake, it will be scary. It will be very scary for the world. But Chairman Mao said that, yes, China is a lion, but we will be awake in the future. We will be certainly awake in the future, but we are a peaceful and lovely lion. We can be the contributor to the global peace and global development. We are devoted to give hands to all developing countries. We want to become united, and we can strengthen our collaboration to promote the multipolarization of the world, to promote the world's economic globalization.
Very nice. Mr. Ambassador, you know, I mentioned this also when we had our conversation with the ambassador of Russia. The late Zbigniew Brzezinski, the strategist, the American strategist, in his final book, he talked about that the nightmare scenario, the most dangerous scenario for the Americans is if China, Russia, and Iran have an alliance, have a strategic alliance. So, you know, there's an expression in English language, they say, you know, the person is spinning in their grave. The person is having a difficult time when they're in their grave. Do you think now that we have come to this point in world history where Mr. Brzezinski's worst case scenario is coming to be true? Iran, China, and Russia are entering a strategic alliance. We will talk about the 25-year strategic alliance between China and Iran. Do you think that we are entering into the scenario that Brzezinski was talking about in the late 20th century, where we're entering the post-American world order, and it is actually being done by this triple alliance between China, Russia, and Iran? If you could please give your analysis of this for us.
Now, you studied international relations, and I am a diplomat. Now, the predictions of Brzezinski are at our hands. So I should say that the Cold War has come to the end. But unfortunately, the brains of some people and their mentality have stayed in the same place, in the era of Cold War, and have remained like before. They put forward some concepts, like the conflicts between civilizations. They start confrontations between countries. Perhaps you have noticed that Secretary Blinken of the U.S. State Department some time ago announced the American approach regarding China. Of course, he has announced similar approaches towards Iran and Russia. They use a lot of different words to define their approaches towards us, like competition, like investment, and like alliances. For Iran, they use the tool of sanctions. They're trying to suppress Iran. And for Russia, they are now using sanctions as well. They use NATO at the same time. They are trying to build a siege in Europe against Russia. So I could say that their mentality is much different than ours. It is against global security. Our ideas are different. China, Russia, and Iran, we are independent countries. We have good collaboration in different scenarios and different organizations. Like Iran, for example, is about to become the formal member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And not long ago, Iran was invited to join the BRICS Plus activities. So we are strengthening our cooperation from the perspective of development and security. We are not trying to build a so-called strategic alliance like NATO. We are not trying to make new Cold Wars. We are not trying to confront other countries. So as I said before, China will never seek hegemony. We will never make military alliances with other countries. But actually, for the time being, there are some countries which are making military alliances, especially in the neighboring countries of China. We are strongly against these actions. China, Iran, and Russia have emerging markets. We're the most important developing countries. We should encourage more developing countries to join us. We should work together to fight against unilateralism, to fight power politics and hegemony. We are always against U.S. sanctions against Iran. We're also not supportive of the U.S. to transport large amounts of weapons to Ukraine in order to prolong this Ukraine crisis. For the Ukraine crisis, we always encourage political and diplomatic ways. We should encourage negotiations to address these problems.
Well, it's interesting, Mr. Ambassador, because, you know, it's what we see the Americans doing today in 2022 is exactly the policy that the British were doing 100 years before that, which is they don't want a united Eurasia. They don't want a strong, united, powerful countries in Eurasia like China, like Russia, like Iran, so that they can control Eurasia, because in their strategic thinking, this is not some sort of guess from us. This is in their own books, Alfred Mackinder, Alfred Mahan, those strategists in the 19th century, late 19th century, early 20th century, talking about that the goal, the strategic goal, is to prevent to prevent Eurasia to become powerful, and for Anglo-America to control the world, they have to control Eurasia. So this is why we see the Ukraine. They're pressuring Russia with Ukraine. They are creating, security issues as it relates to Taiwan and China's sovereignty and its own region there. You mentioned Quad. You didn't mention it. You indicated the issue of Quad and the things they're doing with Japan and India. And, of course, in West Asia, we have these constant securitization as it relates to Iran, Israel, other countries. Of course, you know, the joke is, in international relations, there's a joke that we say among the international relations scholars. We say that in the Cold War between the Soviet Union and America, China was the winner. So this is this is in terms of what you're talking about. So, Mr. Ambassador, I want to now go finally to the issue of Iran-China relations. We had the very, very important, significant signature of the 25-year strategic agreement between China and Iran in the previous administration, which was a surprise for some people because, of course, that administration was famous for trying to come to an agreement with the West. But actually, we explained in our conversation with Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian that these issues are strategic issues in Iran. These are not related to one administration to the other. And this issue of trying to get to a strategic agreement with China has been a long process. This was not something that just recently happened. This has been going on for many years, and it was concluded at that time. And I would argue that this was not simply a bilateral agreement between two countries, which was, of course, important for both countries, but it had a global significance. It was a signal to the world. We saw that immediately the West had reactions to it as it relates to, for example, the negotiations about this JCPOA. It was a signal for the rest of the world. And because it is so sensitive and because it is so important, of course, those who don't like this strategic alliance to happen, of course, have a very strong propaganda war against it, a very strong propaganda campaign against it. As you know, Iran has historically was dominated by the British and then the Americans before the revolution. So we still have many of the people that are connected to that time and are used for this purpose in Iran. And so immediately when this strategic agreement happened, there was, you know, things like, well, this is just China getting cheap oil from Iran, and it's going to just dump low-quality products into the Iranian market. It's going to ruin Iranian manufacturing. This is all in favor of China. Iran has sold itself to China. Of course, those who are within this process, who are part of the political process, know that this is not true. But for the general public, for those who are not familiar with the details of what's going on, what is it? What are the important aspects of this strategic agreement? Is it really just about China getting cheap oil for 25 years and giving Iran, you know, cheap manufactured products, or is there more to this? If you could please explain, from the Chinese perspective, what is it that made China decide to enter into a long-term agreement with Iran?
Before answering your question about China and Iran relations, I would like to say a few more words about multilateralism. July 3rd is the 25th anniversary of Hong Kong's return to China. Before that, it was under colonialist rule of Britain. There was no democracy back then. But now, Hong Kong people can attend elections and choose the head of their government through elections. They can choose their own legislations. But presently, some countries with the thought of colonialism still use Hong Kong as an excuse to attack China. They still have the Cold War mentality. They are still seeking hegemony and power politics. You just mentioned the Taiwan issue and the Ukraine crisis. I should emphasize that Taiwan's question is totally different from the Ukraine crisis. Ukraine is an independent country, but Taiwan historically belongs to China. So the issue of China is totally an issue of Chinese internal affairs. But some countries, they are making nonsense about this issue. They proclaim that the mainland China is making military threats against Taiwan. It is totally nonsense. People in Taiwan are our brothers and sisters. We will never harm them, but we are strongly against the independence of Taiwan. We will never allow foreign countries to to intervene in this issue. If the situation becomes like that, we will have the final say on how to solve the Taiwan issue. Chinese people will never agree and say a big no to foreign countries intervening. And in terms of China-Iran relations, let's just have a quick flashback about this question. China is in the East and Iran is in the West of Asia. Our friendly cooperation can go back to 2,000 years ago. Last year was depicted as the anniversary of the establishment of our diplomatic ties between China and Iran. During these 50 years of cooperation in the fields of politics, economy, and culture, we were able to keep